with you. That is the fastest way I know to flash out all the Anglicans. Welcome to Pagoda. Can you raise your hand if this is your first visit to Pagoda? Right, I'm not sure what's taking you so long, but welcome. Can I also ask you, just as a matter of interest, if you can raise your hand if you would admit to be being employed by the Church of England? Right, we're here with a vested interest, clearly. The question we have is the Church of England worth saving? I noticed that the next scheduled event in this venue is titled Death is Not the End. Which comes as something of a relief, but we shall see. I'm very pleased to welcome Linda Woodhead, Jane Shaw and Andrew Brown. Andrew writes religion for The Guardian. Linda is surely one of the most sensible voices in the church today. And Jane brings a wealth of experience, currently as Dean of Grace Cathedral in San Francisco and moving very shortly to Stanford University. We have the immense privilege this evening of eavesdropping on their conversation, so please give them a wonderfully warm welcome.
Thank you so much. That's very surprising and very nice. And lovely to see so many of you. I am taking it as a kind of I'm taking it very personally because it was my question, is the Church of England worth saving? And actually it's a completely genuine question. It's not just a rhetorical device because I am an Anglican raised in the Church of England. I've always been an Anglican. It's very important to me, but I genuinely struggle with the religion I'm born into. And sometimes I think, I'm very schizophrenic, sometimes I think it is the most wonderful privilege to be part of this church. At various points in my life, I felt that very strongly. And sometimes I completely despair of elements of it and think it is just awful. So, so it is a genuine question. And when I have a question, I always think it's better to ask lots of people because lots of heads are better than one. So thank you for coming to help answer the question. And we really do want to have lots of participation. We will be asking you for your views. There's a roving mic because it's very hard to hear if you're not amplified. And we will, you know, even if it's a matter of passing it from hand to hand, we'll do it, and we'll give lots of chance for a lot of participation. So I hope you're really up for that. I have the two perfect people to discuss this with. We've just met to talk about what we're going to say, and it turns out that we have someone who's going to think the Church of England is worth saving on my left. And on my right, someone who is genuinely skeptical about that, Andrew. So just one clarification. People have been asking, saving from what? Is this about salvation or whatever? No. This is about numerical death. I'm a sociologist, and I love looking at the figures, and have done some very big surveys recently, and the results surprised and alarmed even me. Things are really very bad. If you look at the number of people in Great Britain who call themselves Anglican or Church of England, amongst over 60s, that's the majority of people in the whole of Great Britain. When you get down now, it declines every generation. When you get down to people in their 20s, it's getting down to 10%. So the decline is extremely rapid in the number of people who call themselves Anglican. And of course, we know that church going, as well as the occasional offices, are all declining very fast. Another interesting result from one of my surveys, we asked people about their attitudes to the Church of England, the general population. And a few people said they thought it was a negative force in society. A few people said they thought it was a positive force in society, but the overwhelming, almost 60%, said neither positive nor negative. And in a way, that's really awful that people don't, well, maybe it's good that they don't feel extremely negative about it, But it's not encouraging that people say, well, neither really. Perhaps that reinforces my question and why this is a real question. So I'm going to hand over to Jane to start to convince us that the Church of England is worth saving.
Okay, so I do think the Church of England is worth saving, but it doesn't need to be saved just from numerical decline. I think it needs to be saved from itself. Because one of its responses, especially institutionally, if that makes sense, it seems to me, to this numerical decline, is that it's become more inward-looking and more churchy. I'm always saying to my cathedral staff, for goodness sake, don't be so churchy, because we've got to engage with the community. So I think it has the resources in its own tradition and its own life to save itself. And I would say, I'd want to make the case, there are three things I think it needs to do. First of all, be a diverse church. A shout out to that wonderful organisation, Diverse Church. But also, the Church of England has always aspired to be a broad church. Idealistically, it's a broad church. It's never been a confessional church. It's never
said. Jane, that's not strictly speaking.
Let me finish this point, Andrew. Then you can interrupt. It's never been a church which has said you've got to believe six impossible things before breakfast. The only people who have to sign up to things are those of us who are ordained, 39 articles. Otherwise, we say the historic creeds and show up to worship, right? So I'm talking ideally. I'm not saying we've always lived up to this well.
Well, I think as an ideal, it's very new. Well, okay, maybe 100 years old, because throughout the 19th century, the evangelicals were trying to put the Anglo-Catholics in jail and occasionally succeeding. Throughout the 19th century, the evangelicals were trying to put the Anglo-Catholics in jail. And if you look back through the perfectly wonderful 100 years ago column in the Church Times, you'll notice that there was no great enthusiasm for diversity of views from among the Anglo-Catholics either. We've always been a broad and tolerant church strikes me as rather like the tolerance of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in its decline. When you can't actually enforce uniformity, it suddenly comes to seem unattractive.
I was going to mention the act of uniformity, yes. Isn't very broad. It's about doing the same thing.
But don't you think there is a potential ideal in the Church of England with its parochial system and its capacity for a ministry of presence actually to be thriving?
Who's going to pay for it, Jane?
Who is going to, Andrew? Yeah.
Well, thank you. I think the Church of England that you believe exists or should exist would be worth saving, but it's not going to survive.
Well, you know, I'm now in the Episcopal Church, so what I really spend most of my life doing is raising money, actually, because I get your point, which is, you know, Episcopal churches don't have any great resources from anywhere, so if we want to survive, we have to raise the money, and actually in the end you do that.
But then aren't you going to cut against it being a broad church? Because, the way that the funding is actually going, which isn't particularly planned, but the way it's going is that each congregation has to raise its parish share.
Yes.
And that's going to make it more like the States, where you're going to get a congregationally based church, and the richest congregations are already starting to call a tune about the doctrine of the church. That tail's wagging the dog.
So that's one problem, yes.
The funding model is cutting against broadness, isn't it? Because if you want to be a broad church for the whole of society, you can't let the congregations be the people who are setting
the congregation. Put it very shortly, if the power follows the money, the people who can't be bothered to pay, who are the largely indifferent, the ones outside the church for whom it was supposed to exist, won't matter anymore.
Well, that's not my experience in the States, actually. That there's a kind of, if you begin to have a kind of community engagement through the arts and through, you know, we have 650 people doing yoga in the cathedral every Tuesday night. If you have that kind of engagement, actually people are willing. And maybe that's a peculiarly American thing, but I also don't want to go down this rabbit hole of money for too long, okay, because I'm a bit worried we could, well, go down a rabbit hole, actually.
Okay, all right.
Yeah?
But isn't that the problem, that the church is caught, the Church of England at the moment is caught between, I mean, it doesn't know whether it is for the whole of society.
Absolutely.
Or it is for churchgoers.
I think that's
exactly
right.
And actually all the mission policy and the strategy is about church going and getting more bums on pews.
Yes.
And then you're forgetting that it is a broad church.
Yep.
And you're forgetting that it was meant to provide values, education, occasional offices, to be there at the most important points in people's lives. And it didn't matter if they didn't go every week and they weren't part of the regular congregation. Yep. It was for everyone.
Yeah, I agree.
So everything that you've said is good about it is going down the tubes.
Well, I'm trying to find some resources from its tradition to help it not
okay.
go down the tubes.
Okay.
I think I started by saying the Church of England needs to be saved from itself in exactly the way. So I'm agreeing with both of you. I mean, I think we're all in agreement on this stage. That's part of the problem. Or to some degree,
sure.
right?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But had you finished your points? Did you have another?
No, I've got another couple of points.
Go on,
maybe
go
I can
on.
Make those. And
yeah.
then maybe we should ask Andrew to say why it shouldn't be saved. I think I want the Church of England not to be afraid of beauty and everything it has that can lead people to the transcendent. We have these extraordinary, beautiful buildings. We often have extraordinarily beautiful liturgy, not always. And I think we should be unafraid of that as a sort of pathway to God, to the divine. And I think thirdly, I would hope that the Church of England might have a chance of being a social conscience to the nation. It would be inappropriate if it were the social conscience, because we live in a multi-faith culture, but it's immensely distressing to see it so behind the curve on certain things. And coming from the Episcopal Church, where we had the row about women and gay people and gay marriage, and then we've sort of got through the other end, I come back and I think, my goodness, this is crazy. Because it's so distressing to see the Church of England become so inward-looking about something. I mean, in the past, it's been very good about speaking into the conditions of the society at the time. I've just been recently rereading William Temple's Christianity in Order, which he wrote in the middle of World War II. And if you read the appendix at the back, it's kind of a blueprint for the welfare state. You know, it informed the Beveridge Report, which created the National Health Service and so on. And there have been plenty of other examples of the ways in which the church has been much more engaged. So I think my overall point is we need to keep being engaged, and I'm very worried it's not.
Okay.
To survive, it's
okay.
got to be engaged in these different ways.
Now, what about God? What is distinctive? What's distinctive about the Anglican God, the Anglican approach to God? Is there something special? And if our theology, actually, it shows forth in our institutions how we behave, what our agendas and concerns are, what kind of a God is the Church of England relating to at the moment? And is it the right, is there some hope there? Is that also part of why you think it's worth saving?
It is, yeah, in that the Church of England seems to me has always, well, I'm going to be countered by Andrew in a moment. He'll give me plenty of examples when he hasn't done this, but it seems to me the Church of England has been open to people's experience in making sense of God, as well as reading scripture and, the moment of community worship. But also, I mean, isn't there something worth saving in the beauty of choral evensong and coming to God through that sense of the transcendent in that way? I think so.
But, you know, we're middle-class intellectuals. We're going to say that's nice, aren't we?
I think that's that's not right to say that, Linda, because actually I think lots and lots of people respond to beauty in walking into these spaces. That's why cathedrals are succeeding in this country, actually. So I don't want to say that's just middle-class intellectuals, even if we are that.
I've just read a lovely study of prayer, thingies, what you call them. It's been a long day. Petitiony things you leave in cathedrals. And
yes, notices on prayer boards, right?
Yes, that's it, thank you.
Petitions on prayer boards.
Okay, but a lot of them... Petitions to God.
I think that's what they
are. A lot of them, I mean, in, much more than in other settings, are prayers for the dead. So it's as if people who even aren't regular, you know, yes. somehow the veil between heaven and earth is thin in this place. There is a sense of the sacred in that place, which is interesting. Just to say another really intellectually thing, I've always thought the Church of England is really lovely in its openness to truth, to honesty, to questing, to scholarship. It's got a fantastic record in some ways. I'm nervous about Andrew now. He's glaring. I can feel the glare of that.
He's going to get a big say in a minute.
But that seems to be really in danger at the moment as well.
It is, except that I look around and I see a younger generation, much younger than me, of really serious scholar priests. So I am hopeful about that, actually.
Okay, and where do you see real vitality in which parts of the church now? Is it in churchmanships of certain kinds? Is it in, you know, a particular... Is it all over the place, or...?
Well, that's what we want to hear from all of these people, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Where the life is and where, what you
that's
think
that's what we
want to
know.
Saving.
We want to know from you where you think the life
okay,
is.
Okay, good deflection. Andrew?
Well, I'm a cathedral dean. I think it's a lot of it's in cathedrals, but I think a lot of what's happening in cathedrals is also happening in churches as well, but... Cathedrals have captured attention recently in England.
What about the whole charismatic upsurge and the real focus on the body, experience, healing, you know, real life issues? Is that something worth saving? Is that a direction where you see...
I think you're more up to date on that than I am because you're a sociologist and I'm a historian.
Another good deflection. Another good deflection. Okay, Andrew.
I should say possibly that my argument is it suggests that I'm here under false pretenses because I obviously think that bits of the Church of England are worth saving because I've spent so much of my life writing about it that it would be really impossibly disheartening to consider the idea that I wasted all those years. on the other hand, the bits that are worth saving and that are valuable, and I would largely agree with both Jane and Linda about what those are the bits that seem to me to be under threat or to already to have vanished. The underlying problem is that the England of which this was the church has disappeared. The old establishment of the imperial state, where it made complete sense for William Temple to sit down and sketch out the welfare state, just doesn't exist anymore, in case you noticed it came to an end in 1979, and by now we should have noticed. And in the, 25 years I've been writing about religion, I've watched the Church of England drifting away from the centre of affairs, drifting away from being taken seriously by politicians. In some ways this is completely unfair, but it has happened, and it's taken the central institutions a very long time to notice this. They've done a lot of damage in the meantime by pretending that they're more important than they are. Again, the role of the church as a sort of carrier of a certain kind of what is now elite culture seems to me wonderful and worth keeping. I love the prayer book. I love all the cathedral stuff. On the other hand, one of the most interesting and effective books about the Church of England I've read for a while was called If You See George Herbert on the Road, Kill Him. And this was by a parish priest, a thoughtful, intelligent, hardworking man, like all my friends in parish ministry, who finds the job simply impossible. And the George Herbert-type pretensions of being, you know, there for everyone in the parish just don't make any sense anymore. If you try to live up to that, you will be ground down. But if you take that away, what exactly are we left with? I mean, in a tolerant, liberal, individualistic, multicultural, multi-faith society, if the Church of England is not established both in the formal sense and in the real sense of being felt as a vital part of the way this country understands itself, both in big things and little things, then what's the point of it? It's just going to shrivel into one among many competing bodies. And in that process, an awful lot of what makes it rather wonderful will be lost.
But haven't you just said something completely contradictory? So you said that the England, you know, of which it was part has gone, the idea you can be established over everything and everyone and blueprint the nation's future, gone. But then you've said it can't go to being just one church amongst others because then it's lost its raison d'etre.
Yeah, I mean... So
it's not contradictory, it makes perfect sense.
Something called... Something called the Church of England may survive.
But it's not going to be worth having.
It would be like the Holy Roman Emperor.
And you just can't get it back to what it was, so...
No, can't go back.
I mean, I must say, when I just... You know, last year was the 50th anniversary of John Robinson's Honest to God, which was, you know, a sort of pivotal moment in some ways in relationship to not only theology, but also how people thought about doing church. And I think... What struck me in rereading it and reading some of the stuff about South Bank religion and all that stuff from that period was that the assumption that they would always be the establishment, even while they were undoing it, was absolutely huge. So I do think Andrew is onto something here, actually, that we don't quite know how to be. And I wonder if you think, Andrew, that the pattern is, maybe Linda as well, maybe I can be the questioner now. You know, Diana Butler Bass writing about American religion and the decline of the mainline Protestant denominations there thinks that we're just going to have a few central hubs here and there. Big churches are going to afford to keep going, and they'll have little satellites which might not even be in church buildings. Do you think that's where we're going?
I think people really want religion to continue to resource their lives, and the Church of England is best placed to do that, of anything, for all sorts of reasons. But that's an occasional engagement with it. Yes, perhaps at really, really important moments of your life, but if the church is going to be that, so that's where I think that actually it has still got a future in being broad in the way that you say. I think it's got to be incredibly radical and creative in rethinking how it looks out, as you said, and meets people where they really are in their lives with their particular issues at those moments of crisis and death and joy. Yeah. And it's going to have to think about a very different way of funding, to go back to the money question. But look, we've been talking for quite a long time, so let's see what you think on any of these issues. If you'd like to chip in, put your hand up, and first come, first served.
Thank you. Can I just say, the Church of England you're talking about, Choral Evensong, Book of Common Prayer, it's not the Church of England that I see setting up food banks, credit unions, mums and toddlers groups, messy church. And isn't the problem that we're measuring the wrong thing? We're not measuring engagement, we're just counting numbers on a Sunday. And how can we find ways to measure our engagement that's better and find ways to engage with those sorts of activities rather than just saying, come to a Sunday service?
Can I answer?
Yeah, go on.
I completely agree, and one of my big frustrations always as a cathedral dean has been that the Episcopal Church, on the one hand, demands I report Sunday numbers, and on the other hand says you should be having yoga because that will get loads of people in. You should be doing all the things we do. We do a lot of feeding of homeless, but that's never counted in any way. So I completely agree with you. And, you know, I would include in the kind of social engagement thing I talked about, the social conscience thing I talked about, exactly what you're saying. I think... for me, the biggest issue of the day is the environment, without any question whatsoever, and I think the church needs to engage with that. I'm thrilled that Archbishop Welby has begun to talk about money. I minister in Silicon Valley, so obviously I think technology is something we should be thinking about, and the ethics of technology. So I'm totally with you on all of that, yeah.
Well, my comeback to that is not that any of these things are a bad idea, but there's nothing special about the Church of England doing them. You know, I sat in, I suppose I can say this here in not breaking any secrets, I sat in on a committee that Philip Blond was involved in, his think tank, Res Publica, about how they could rescue the Church of England by basically turning it into the local offices of the Department of Social Security. You know, it would do all this stuff. And even if that were realistic, which it isn't, from the point of view of the government, there's no reason whatever to pick the Church of England out of all the various competing denominations to do that kind of delivery.
Okay, next.
I mean, this is, again, it's sort of hangover of the fantasy of establishment.
Which follows...
Sorry, I was just about to.
That fitted quite nicely with what I was about to say, because I was going to say I come from the part of the Church of England that was saved 100 years ago, the Church in Wales, which was disestablished. And you've obviously mentioned establishment. Should the Church of England be disestablished? And if it is, can it survive? Mind you, if it isn't, can it survive? But I realise that's trying to get the entire seminar in one question.
Well, I mean, what do you think, given the experience in Wales?
Well, not having been there in 1920, we struggled hugely with losing the endowments, which were handed out to the county councils. 100 years on, from being possibly the third largest denomination, we are the largest, but only because they've shrunk faster than we have. And equally, we are struggling with exactly the same questions. We carry out the same type of work. Obviously, fewer cathedrals, but still, I don't think we've got quite the same draw to Llandaff and Bangor, whatever their strengths, as you may have to St. Paul's or wherever. Still, disestablishment has allowed us, when we're talking about archbishops, it's allowed our current archbishop, Archbishop Barry, to be much more direct about issues that have arisen, particularly in Wales, but also in England. And of course, with the devolved government in Wales, that gives us a slightly different voice anyway. Yeah. But also, when William Temple, great hero, but can you think of a single archbishop since, with the exception perhaps of Rowan Williams, who's tried to do the same sort of thing? And you think of Cosmo Lang, who preceded him. Cosmo was never going to start up an argument about creating a welfare state, was he?
Okay, let's have a little vote on establishment. Who thinks that we should keep the established status of the church? And who thinks we should disestablish? Oh, 50-50, isn't it?
Who's abstaining?
60-40.
No? Oh, who's abstaining? Interestingly, when you ask the public, it's yes 10%, no 10%. Haven't got a clue. Overwhelming majority. There's a point here. I think we should either have more establishment, or much less, or none. But we're in the worst place at the moment. We're neither a state church. The law might change. We take no notice whatsoever. We try and oppose Parliament, and Parliament is the best expression of Anglican opinion still, but we ignore it, or we get rid of it. But at the moment, it's neither one nor thing the other. That's my view. There's a gentleman here, and then there's going to be a lady in the middle with her hand up there, so you've got to... Yeah, Kate, thanks.
I think you've summed it up. I was only going to suggest that I'm not sure it really makes any difference.
Yeah, right.
I think that's a question. It might have made a difference in 1920, but would it make a difference in 2020, I think, is a real question.
So two things to say. First, to the gentleman who spoke before, I come from Scotland, from the Anglican Church in Scotland, where we are not the established church, but we are seeing growth and diversity in, paradoxically perhaps, the more traditional expressions of worship that the C of E would have held dear, out with the evangelical and HTB forms of church in particular. So that's one comment. My question, however, is...
Just explain that to us. In parishes, you mean? Or?
Well, we don't have parishes because we're not the state church. We have charges, uh-huh. But there are local state... There are local congregations where the worship in the Scottish Episcopal Church is, by and large, predominantly slightly more Anglo-Catholic than you would find perhaps in your average market town in England.
And that's appealing to young people?
It is. It's being seen perhaps more in larger, in city contexts than it is in rural contexts. but there is the added complexity that the Anglican Church there, despite its best intentions, is still viewed as the English Church by many people. So that's an issue.
Okay.
But my question really was about the ways we might save the Anglican Communion. If we're talking about beauty and leading to the transcendent, as was talked about, Nadia Bolz-Weber in her talk on Friday talked about favouring participation over perfection. And I wonder what you would have to say about the role of participation over perfection, particularly perhaps in larger and more traditional congregations in the Church of England.
Yeah, I was saying in my talk that participation is a major theme of what people want at the moment, and churches are still pretty passive for a lot of lay people. But Andrew, any chance to... Jane, any thoughts on...
Well, what I think is that participation goes against what was the self-image, what was the dominant ethos of the Church of England when I started writing about it, which was, we are here for the people who are outside us. You know, the Church of England was an institution that existed for the benefit of people who didn't go to church. And that simply is not sustainable. And I think that, I mean, that is one distinctive part of it, which I think can't be saved. I may regret it, but the more participation you have, you get growth, but of a completely different sort. That's the only thing which will, in fact, rescue the institution. Of course it is.
Another, I mean, I said a kind of silly thing to you, because I said, well, young people going, but actually, when you look at the figures, if the church is going to revitalise, we're kind of the last generation in which there are an awful lot of us who've got a lot of commitment and goodwill to the church, and the church is not allowing us to participate, and that's a major failure, chasing after people who aren't participating and ignoring the huge pool of resource of people who would actually quite like to, but there's not really much scope for it. Okay, there's a... where's the microphone? Oh, you're there, you're hiding down there. Okay. Let's have, let's move a bit to this side of the room. We're being a bit mean. Yes, please. This gentleman just there with a blue armband and a beige T-shirt with a white undershirt.
Thank you. It seems to me that there are many members of the Universal Church who are very happy to be members of the Universal Church who hold their denominational identity very, very lightly. And I think that's particularly true the younger people get. So there's lots of people who may happily attend a Church of England church if that's where they happen to be in life. But at another time, they might attend a Catholic church, an evangelical church, a Methodist church, whatever. And I think this is something that the institutional hierarchies haven't really got their heads around, this kind of floating people who don't really care for the badge, they care for the experience and perhaps what they can get out of it, how that might be positive or negative.
I mean, whether you can meet God there, that's not negative, is it? Jane.
Well, the famous sociologist Linda Woodhead might call this mash-up religion, I think, right? So it's not just different forms of Christianity, it's also you might be a Christian Buddhist. As a historian, I would say that's been going on a long time. So in the 18th century, you might go to Church of England in the morning, but then you might go to the Methodist in the evening. In the early 20th century, which was a moment of great disillusionment with institutional religion, especially after the First World War, a lot of the groups I've worked on, they might go to Church of England on Sunday, but they're going to go to a Buddhist talk on Wednesday and maybe theosophy meeting on Thursday. So I think this kind of pick-and-mix religion has been going on quite a long time, actually, and the institutional church has difficulty recognising that. Absolutely, yeah.
Next question. Just keep going sort of to your... Yes, follow your instincts.
So I'd like your response to just connecting up with Linda's previous talk a day or so ago. I heard you say, Linda, that there's a lot of spiritual hunger in the UK. Your study in Kendal showed there was institutional decline, but you said lots of spiritual activity and hunger, and the institutions weren't serving it. So I'd love to hear from all three of you what is it the institutional leaders and half the people in this room who are from the institution need to face? Because in my read, I'm an organizational consultant. I did one piece of work with a bishop and his archdeacons in one of the major cities. And I did something very ordinary in terms of what we normally do. And he said, oh, this is wonderful. So what really worries me is what goes on at the deanery synod in the bishops, and will the institution kill itself? Because I think outside in the world there's a huge hunger. I used to be a member of Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. I live there. It's a wonderful, vibrant place. We were there 2 weeks ago. So there are places that do things, but what worries me is the institutional leaders and the fear of the vicar and the policing of a dying institution will kill the renewal. So what does the church need to face up to? And I look at my own diocese of Chichester, and I think there's a lot of things, there's a lot of great things there at the parish level, but I look at the institution and I feel they're so disconnected, and I see no forces for change in that. I see that's the biggest worry, and I wonder what the three of you think about that.
Andrew's going to say something. I was just going to say, it's very hard in the Church of England. The structure is such, it's incredibly hard for anyone to make a decision. And that's really a paralyzing situation. It's not necessarily there are bad leaders, but no one can make any change. And it's always somebody else's committee or someone else's group, or it's extremely hard to know who you'd go to get a change. Have we got any senior clergy, bishops? Will you admit to your presence in the room? Archdeacons?
Deans or canons?
Hey!
Andrew. Can I say that what you said has puzzled me for years. How is it that an institution full of people who are individually smart, talented, imaginative, hardworking, should be absolutely none of those things when it meets as a collective? obviously, your glancing mention of deanery synods put the finger on part of the problem. I mean, there's that lovely definition of a deanery synod as a room full of Anglicans who wish they were somewhere else. And this kind of word quasi-democracy is obviously disastrous. I don't quite know. I think Linda's point about you can't find anyone to make a decision is a consequence of again, a shift away from the old militaristic, imperialist British state, where there was a very clear model, you know, decision-making authority was modeled on the army. You were given responsibility. If you screwed up, you were shot. You know, there was no nonsense about the Navy was how they carried that to an extreme, but that was the basic way things got done. And there was no nonsense about sort of due process or, you know, HR or management or anything like that. And obviously this model had drawbacks, especially if you were Admiral Byng. But on the other hand, when you stick on top of it a sort of quasi-corporate Godco culture where the one thing you have to avoid at all costs is failure, which, you know, anything which can be blamed on you, and where there's still no sort of corporate mechanism saying, right, you're no bloody good, out. Then you get this awful paralysis, and you have neither the one thing nor the other. You have neither a sort of modern corporate decision-making body nor an old-fashioned military one. You have the rhetoric of one and a paralysis. And that needs to be cured. I don't know how.
And you don't have, and what really worries me, I think if any organisation is going to live and thrive, it has to be completely connected to the grassroots and what's happening on the ground. And I think that's really, the mechanisms, you know, for reaching down and understanding and allowing things to move and grow. There isn't any even, I would say this, wouldn't I, but there isn't even any research. No one even knows what the hell people think or where the numbers are or nothing about where things are, and that really gives me pause for concern about how is it going to get out of the situation if you don't know where people, the basics.
But also without that engagement with the grassroots at a practical level, I think one of the results is extremely overworked, exhausted clergy. Put your hand up if you think you're an overworked, exhausted clergy person. There you
and
go.
And you can manage the energy to get your hand in the
That was only a small portion. The others couldn't get their hands up. They're too tired, yeah. So I think that's another thing that that's responding a little bit to Andrew's question, which is, you know, clergy are smart, creative, wonderful people who often have given up a lot to do this extraordinarily peculiar job. And they're not always encouraged, they're not always appreciated, and they're often overworked, precisely because we haven't got that kind of
And the really awful thing
grounding.
Is people, I've been having some really fascinating conversations this weekend, and the thing that really my heart goes out to is clergy and members of congregations coming and saying, look, we're in real serious trouble, this congregation, what can we do? Yes. And the tragedy is that you can't solve that yourself as a congregation. Yeah. There has to be a higher level of thinking and planning and supporting, and it's impossible, and yet the burden is really felt deeply by people who have that sense of responsibility. Let's take some more over here, please. Yes, you're already poised. Go.
I've got the microphone. I'll stick with it.
Yeah.
Linda, you often contrast a congregational model that you see as being inward-looking and ultimately negative and a church that's free to serve the local community. And you're attracted, I know, by the Danish model where the government pays for that, basically. It seems to me where we are at the moment is we need to build congregations whose vision of God is such that they are inspired to serve the local community. So it's congregations who are serving.
I mean, the church is—it's a kind of state. It's a congregational church with a state church wrapping, like the Church of Denmark. So I don't think it's either or, and I don't. I really do think it should be a diverse church, and there is room for a range of models. But I think if it stops thinking it is for society and the common good, then it's in serious trouble. And the Church of Denmark isn't funded by the state. Only 10% is the state, as it is here, actually. The state funds massively through all sorts of things, council tax relief and charitable status and so on. But it's the people who pay voluntarily to it. But there's a long history of that, which there isn't here, so I don't think you can directly do that. But I do think there are a lot of people who are not regular churchgoers who have a lot of goodwill for the church and for many of the things it does, who would be prepared to pay if they could see what, if there was a proper campaign, if you could see what your money was being spent on, whether locally or more than that. People want to pay for issues and things that they care about in their communities. Let's keep going. Let's have some women, please, please, please. There's a lady just by your, there we are.
Hi, thanks, that was really interesting. I work for the Student Christian Movement, and one of the things that you said right at the beginning was that 10% of people in their 20s identify as Anglican, and I wanted to know what the panel thought about that and what the solution is. What I see is quite a lot of infighting and different denominations fighting over the people that are left, particularly young people. And also a lot of funding going into chaplaincy, which I think is fantastic, but that I think falls into the serving the needs of the whole of society. And how do you strike a balance between that and still having people who go to church and are those people that are going to then serve the needs of society? So thoughts on kind of youth and student outreach and leadership and that kind of stuff, please.
I'm not sure what the question is precisely, but I'm happy to try and have a go answering it. I mean, I think one of the problems the Church of England has had is that it hasn't always recognised chaplaincy as a rather valid way of engaging with young people, because it's hived off as sector ministry, and it hasn't always seen that as quite important. So that's one problem that we need to get over. The second problem is something I talked about at the beginning, which I think is the credibility gap. So, you know, the issues that that's all the infighting about just aren't issues for younger generations, so it just seems crazy. And I suppose the third thing is relating to a previous question about pick and mix spirituality, or certainly not necessarily caring so much about one's denomination. And are we going to have to live with a situation where there may only be 10% Anglicans? Is that something? But there will be many other people coming in and out. I mean, is membership just that tight, or is membership being part of a community some of the time? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say a couple of things. I suppose I think the Church of England has unbelievable opportunities and resources that it doesn't make the most of, and that's where it interfaces with society. Yep. And schools and universities are very important places, and I think a lot more could be done to really think creatively about how to do that. And I've completely forgotten what the other thing I was going to say was. So let's move on to another question, and it'll come back to me.
Loud, isn't it? Mine isn't a question, it's a statement. I do think the Church of England is trying to work on the participation and the management thing from the gentleman over here. Certainly in our diocese, they're sponsoring leadership courses for just ordinary congregational people, which are management-style leadership courses to bring into the church people at the normal level, just to take off some of the workload from the vicars, so that the people of the church are now doing the leadership. But we are being trained. I'm fortunate to be on the course. We are being trained, and it's a management-style training. It's not just airy-fairy vision. It's proper training. And I think a lot more of that would be a lot more helpful in the Church of England.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Which diocese, out of interest?
Winchester.
Thank you.
Okay, good. And I remembered what I was going to say, which was, I think you also need to rethink how you socialise. If most people are not being socialised in their families now, I mean, there's a real problem for any kind of religion which took away socialisation. Sorry, that's a sociological jargon, but you know, education,
formation
in
the
faith. Thank you very much. That's it. Took that away from families to clergy. All the ones that did that are in trouble. If you look at religions where, like Islam, like Judaism, where the families do that, it's easier to transmit. But if you've done it, and you're now in the situation where you're getting most young people who are not socialised into what is a very complex religion, actually. The Church of England is a very complex kind of religion. We need to think creatively, and Jewish people are doing this, about how do you initiate and train and educate people into this when they're not getting in the families, and not setting the barriers up very, very high, but having, you know, proper and interesting ways of teaching people about what this church is and what it believes and what its resources are. You're going to say Alpha Course.
If I can say this without being misunderstood, in my limited experience of teenage boys, you want to reach them, you've got to reach them in the bedroom. Everybody lives online now.
Yes, maybe.
I mean, there is an
assumption.
I thought
you meant something else for a moment there. But just spinning around.
No, but there is an assumption in a lot of this talk that if you're going to reach out to people, you have to get them to come into a building that you control, if you see what I mean. An awful lot of
Linda was saying the opposite, I think, actually.
But people come want to re-engage with their heritage, or however vague it might be, or the faith, at various stages in life, and often it's, for example, when you have children. It can be at other ages. We are rapidly running out of time. I can see the editor of the Church Times standing there. He must know why the Church of England is worth saving. Do you want to give us a comment on this, Paul? You need the microphone before you do.
Paul's going to borrow my microphone. Here we go.
Come on.
I'm listening as fascinated as the rest of you to this. I pick up this image of creative people around within the church, and see lots of you here. My question for this lot is, what happens next, really? And I'm going to relinquish my chair again, because if nothing happens, which is by far the most likely thing What's the next thing we're going to see?
Okay, we better take that one by one, Jane.
I think I just want to say to everybody in this room, don't this, and I'm going to sound awfully American here, but that's okay. Don't be afraid to be entrepreneurial. If you have an idea, go for it. Get people on board. Just do it. Raise the money yourself for it. It's actually, you can do it. And get engaged. So don't be afraid. Don't wait for an archdeacon or a bishop to tell you you can do it, because it'll never get done. You know, I think just go for it. If I could empower, yeah.
Actually, I think that's brilliant. You know, there's a lot of let's wait and someone else is going to do it, or let's defer and let's wait till the committee's met, and actually we've just got to get on and do it. What will happen if we don't use all this incredible creative energy that you can see in something like Greenbelt? I don't go for the doomsday scenario, you know, there won't be a church in 10 years or anything like that. I don't think that's true. But we were talking to a guy from Australia who was saying, you'll end up like what happened with us. You just shrink and shrink and shrink until it's a few comfortable congregations who are just doing their thing for themselves. I think that's what is going to happen if we don't do something. Andrew.
Yes, I'd largely agree with that. But although that's what will happen if present trends continue. But I don't think they can. A friend of mine in his 40s said, as sort of towards the end of Rowan's time as Archbishop, of course, all of us in my generation feel just like the last days of East Germany. We know all the official regime is lies. We're just waiting for the wall to come down. And I think that moment is very, very rapidly approaching, at which point there'll be quite a lot of disruption, but there'll also be a lot, possibly last flare-up of creativity and action and people doing stuff. I know that Justin Welby got the job because he was the only candidate who really took seriously the projections of disaster that the church commissioners had got done by statisticians. I mean, people are really frightened. And you may or may not like HTB, but they get stuff done and they think about problems. And they're better than almost anyone else working round the bureaucracy of the Church of England. And that is a skill which could offer the rest of the church.
I think we need, yeah. I think it would help a lot if we were just honest. I think it's a very dishonest church, very often.
And we're just not
we're just not honest enough about how things are. It should be a much more truth-telling church, and I think it, in some ways, it should be much more confident about the fact that it witnesses to a very generous God, and it should be living a generous life. Its institutions should be generous, and we should trust God. We should trust that if we let people flourish, if we let people take decisions, if we trust the resources there are in this church, actually it might come out all right, and we didn't be so afraid. And the great contrick that we're all living in that I hate, which is, you know, clergy say, oh, we mustn't discuss those issues because it'll upset the people in the pews. And the people in the pews think, we can't tell the vicar because he'll be really upset about that. And it's a big contrick, and it's just got to stop now, and we've got to have honest conversations and release some of the resources and the energy. So now I've talked myself into thinking it's worth saving, haven't I?
Yes, you have.
We've got time for just one more question, which I'd promised.
Thank you. I'm sitting here with Diverse Church, who I've encountered just recently, so I don't know much about you guys. And my question's for both them and for you. I've heard you talking about such groups being part of what could save the church, and my question to the group is also, how embedded are you in the Church of England? Do you find it helpful to be embedded in the Church of England? Should we be encouraging such groups to be part of saving the institution, or should we be encouraging such groups to not be, because actually they're serving a wonderful purpose and it could pull them back from what they do?
Okay, well, let's ask them. Is Sally around? Yeah. Go on, Sally, tell us the answer.
Sally, can you tell, just define diverse church,
yes,
in case there are people who don't know what it is?
Great. Hello. So Diverse Church is a group I set up. I'm a university chaplain, and I had lots of young people come and talk to me who are LGBTQ, U, all the other letters, who weren't being supported in their local churches and who were looking for support. And I looked around for something that could support them, couldn't find anything. So we set up a secret Facebook group, and they have got together. And since Easter, we've grown to like over 100 people, and they're supporting each other, and we literally save lives. And we decided not to make it Anglican. I'm an Anglican priest, and one of the reasons we decided not to make it Anglican was because I didn't want my bishop to have to feel responsible for it. I didn't want people to have to worry about what the political consequences were of what we were doing, and we just wanted to help. And rightly or wrongly, I felt that actually it would be better if we were ecumenical.
So tell us, you can have the last word, because I think Sinead O'Connor's getting really worried that there's be nobody there to listen. Tell us why you think, from where you're coming from, that the Church of England is worth saving.
I'm hopeful. I am genuinely hopeful. And I'm hopeful because I speak to so many young people, like in Diverse Church, people who do not identify as straight and who've had a crap time in the church so far. And we have numbers of them who are hoping to get ordained still.
Why?
Because they believe in the ideals of the Church of England. They believe in God. They believe that the fact that the local church can make a difference, and they've seen evidence of that, even if they've also seen evidence of it being rubbish. And even in my university chaplaincy role, I see like people outside the church who are excited by the message that we can bring, not just as Anglicans, but as Christians. And actually, I think the Anglican Church, as an established movement, is paying for my job. And actually, we've got a lot of potential. Like you said, we've got a lot of resources we're not necessarily making the most of. And there are increasing numbers of young adults who still want to sign up for this. And often we have the creativity and we want to bring change, and we still have hope. So
fantastic. That's a really good note to end on. Thank you all very much. Thank you.